Scottish Mortgage seeks out lateral thinkers like academics, authors, and experts in the industry to shape our investment ideas. Not the usual suspects and narrow mindset of financial analysts and investment industry commentators. That way, we continue to build a portfolio that reflects real-world progress, not financial world noise. Scottish Mortgage is managed by Baillie Gifford. A key information document is available by visiting baillieGifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk.
Hello and welcome to The Advice Show. I'm Nicola, a reporter at New Model Advisor, and I'm joined by my colleague Zach Sharif and Branko Bielobaba. Branko is the former vice president of the CII. He was vice president between 2008 and 2014. And he is principal at Branko, a general insurance compliance consultancy. Hi, Branko. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good morning. How are we all today?
Good morning, Nicola. Good morning, Zach. Very good. Thank you.
Brilliant. It's great to have you, Branko. I guess to start off, would you mind just, telling us a bit more about your background and your involvement and time at the CII?
So I joined the insurance industry straight out of school in 1987. And then it was clear that to progress, you had to take professional qualifications. So the Chartered Insurance Institute, there I started. I took my exams, associateship, 3 years, 2 years later, fellowship. But I got involved with something then called the Luton and St Albans Insurance Institute, which is now Luton and Hertfordshire. And then I think we had probably over 80 local institutes, and colleagues from general insurance and financial services got together. But before the PFS, we had something called SOFA, and we had sort of fragmentation in financial services. So when the PFS happened in 2004, two professional bodies came together. The CII sort of sets the syllabus, provides the tuition materials, enables advisors to become qualified. And don't forget, in financial advice, you have to be qualified level 4 minimum to give financial advice. So it's a mandatory requirement set by law. So you're an IFA, you have to be qualified to do your job, and you have to be signed off annually as competent, which is where the CII and the PFS come into this, in that you can study, you can be accredited, and you're signed off as competent. So I've been a volunteer at my local institute since, blimey, no, gosh, 1991. So coming up for 32 years, which, you know, I started 18. So it's obvious that, you know, I've been involved for some time. But I enjoy meeting people. I enjoy listening to them. I enjoy educating general insurance people. I enjoy the networking. And then, you know, national, as it were, I got a call. Well, I got involved nationally on representative council, on the board. I was asked to serve as vice president. I think I've spoken at all the CII's local institute dinners. So I enjoy what I do, and I'm still here. So very much part and parcel now of the local CII.
Absolutely. That sounds great. And if you wouldn't mind, could you give us an overview, sort of in your own words, of the recent disputes between the CII and the PFS? I mean, obviously, you know, there's a sort of long storied history, as I'm sure you'll go into. But it would be great to get your opinion on the matter.
Yeah, what stuck out to you?
And to also potentially...
This is a bit like a family tiff. This is like an argument that's gone wrong at a Christmas dinner table many years ago, and no one wants to seem to sort it out. So it is a bit of a battle royal now, in that PFS colleagues seem to have been rubbed up badly by the CII. And I speak just as an observer. I am not privy to anything confidential. But what I see is, you know, a couple of years ago, under the previous chief exec, Sian Fisher, various changes were made. So Aldermanbury, the building that the CII had its City of London offices in, was sold. That realised a lot of money. There's a pension scheme deficit, a legacy that goes back many years. There are other issues in terms of, you know, who runs what, who earns the money. The PFS seems to have built up a huge amount of money, I think about £20 million. Whether that is available to the group, because when it's reported on the balance sheet, it's reported as group consolidated funds. And people are saying, and I've not looked at this in any deep detail, that PFS is very rosy financially, but the CII has suffered through COVID financially, and it would appear that earnings are down on the CII side compared to the PFS side, because CII people choose to be qualified. The employer asks them to be qualified, but it's not mandatory. You don't have to be qualified in general insurance to be a practitioner, but you know, as I've said, on the financial services side, you do. So you can't practice without a qualification. So PFS operates slightly differently to the CII in that we have now, I think, 55, 56 local institutes, but I think from memory there are 26 PFS regions. Again, run by volunteers, but PFS people get their CPD program provided by the centre, and yeah, they just have to dip out. It's provided for them, whereas the CII provides some stuff nationally, but locally, we local institutes receive a grant, an amount of money, which covers our ability, provides money for us to provide training to CII and PFS members in the local institutes. And it's whether we can engage with PFS colleagues who are already getting a lot of this straight away. But, you know, we had an Ambassadors in Action conference last May in Birmingham, and PFS and CII people in the same room. And what became quickly obvious was that CII and PFS people didn't quite understand how each other worked. But we sort of got in touch, you know, Luton and Hertfordshire, with our local PFS individual, and he's now on board on our council, which is like our running committee, and we then better understand what the PFS has to do, because we receive PFS money into the local institute too. But another thing nationally is, you know, the CII decided, they cited issues of corporate governance failures, so they wanted more CII people on the PFS board. And to me, that's sort of, you know, you're then able to control what goes on. It's a fait accompli, because if there's six of you and five of them, well, you're going to win the vote every time. And to me, that looked a little bit awkward. And if we go back to last October, I, together with Grant Scott, also a previous vice president, we put forward a motion at the AGM of the CII just to air this, to see what had really happened, to conduct an independent review. But unfortunately, that didn't meet the criteria for AGMs at the time. But now, you know, any 50 members of the CII, a PFS member, you are a member of the CII, you can call for a special general meeting, but it has to have the support of the engagement members on the board that represent bits of interest within the CII membership. So I don't know where that is. So to me, it's to do with finance, corporate governance, whether the two bodies can trust each other going forward, because they have their own separate chief executives. And Alan Valance has been really working closely with the PFS, Doug, with the PFS chief exec. And to me, we should be really transparent and honest. PFS members should not be losing trust with a chartered body that's been around since 1897. But the way individuals or whatever have behaved has clearly wound up colleagues within the PFS.
Absolutely. And I think it's a really good point you made earlier on, talking about the sort of, you know, the structure and history of the organisations, that the CII ultimately holds chartered status over, you know, the PFS and people who want to be chartered in this country as a financial advisor. And I think we can come back to that as a systemic thing later on. But that was really interesting. Thank you for that detailed response. I mean, obviously, as you explored this, a major catalyst in the recent developments was the CII board appointments to the PFS. Do you think this was, and you mentioned there that it could seem quite awkward, do you think that this was motivated or influenced by the financial disputes they're having? I mean, you know, the PFS 20 million, I understand, is technically a loan given by the PFS. So do you think that had any sort of any bearing on the developments that we saw in the board?
I think, Zach, you can take two views on this. As a bystander, if you're going to fill the board with your appointees, you're only going to do that to ensure that the decisions are the decisions that you want to have. I am not an accountant. I don't know how the 20 million chops up. Alan Valance did some talks with local institutes and members that wanted to attend a couple of weeks ago, and he made it clear, you know, that is not the CII's money. I don't know what sort of constraints are attached to that money, whether that money is available to the CII as an entity or whether it's group money. I really don't know, so it would be best to ask someone directly at the PFS. But to me, it appears, you know, worst case scenario, it would be a raid of cash to augment CII's finances. But I don't know personally how that stacks up on the balance sheet. But to put CII appointees onto the board of the PFS to cite corporate governance failings, you know, I don't know if that's entirely fair and what the rationale and the evidence behind that was, and one would hope it's all kosher, as it were, because that has created a massive furore amongst PFS members, because it would appear that, you know, Big Brother is bullying you into making the decisions that Big Brother wants.
Branko, some of those concerns you mentioned, you said that they sort of motivated you and another former president to try and call an EGM last year. I was just wondering, what would you have hoped to sort of address and raise in that meeting, and what would you have hoped to sort of get from it?
Yeah, Grant and I, and don't forget Grant also did this the year before, we were calling for an independent review, sort of a warts and all analysis as to a number of key decisions that had been made in the, say, the past 3 to 5 years that have led to this position. So, you know, is the CII financially stable on its own? What have we done to upset the PFS? What options are available to the PFS going forward? Is a breakup on the cards? Why did the PFS president resign her position mid-term? These things have never happened before. So we were asking the membership to vote for this independent review so that we can understand why previous decisions were made and why are we here now. The CII should be open to a challenge from all stakeholders. It must carry the faith and the support of the industry and the sector going forward. The fact that we're spending a lot of time on this and not dealing with the issues that we should be dealing with in terms of consumer confidence in insurance and financial services, especially during times of financial crisis and whatever you wish to call it, you know, to me, we should be concentrating on other things. So the AGM motion would have enabled that to happen, but it was a two-parter. The first bit is, do you want to discuss or air a motion before we even looked at what the motion was actually calling for? And it's, you know, it was voting, and unfortunately we didn't get the number of votes required and we fell at the first hurdle. But now, you know, colleagues are calling for something similar, just to ensure that decisions going forward are being made for the right reason.
Absolutely. And you mentioned earlier, I think it was in Luton, you said that there was a meeting between PFS people and CII people, and that
that was Birmingham.
Sorry, Birmingham. Yeah. Getting my cities confused. You mentioned that it was it seemed slightly awkward in terms of people not seeing where each other came from. Do you think that that spoke to sort of broader cultural issues of an insurance body and a financial services trade body? Well,
I think it's when you CII and PFS, I think, came together in 2004. So the two bodies are different, but they should work well together. You know, we're all people. We all enjoy networking. General insurance people have financial services requirements. Financial services people have general insurance requirements. So some practices and offices can work together on that. We're not completely different. And it was PFS not quite understanding how local institutes worked. But Ken, you know, we're very open within the CII to working with PFS colleagues and other professionals in the areas in which we operate, because shared professionalism is a good thing. And as I, you know, I speak a lot in schools, and you know, nothing moves without insurance. You know, everything has to have insurance in order for it to happen. And financial advice, you know, we all should have a pension. You may need life cover, so it may touch some people, but the financial advice sector is worth a huge amount of money, and the general insurance sector is worth a huge amount of money. We employ hundreds of thousands of people within the UK. So there's nothing wrong with the two bodies coming together. So Birmingham was just colleagues getting together to, you know, to discuss what we can do to help members going forward, and for both sides to understand where each other is coming from. But you know, CII locally are the ones that get the money to spend on members, be it CII or PFS. So the PFS needs to work with us in order for the money to be spent locally. But again, back to what I said at the start, if you're a PFS member, everything to do with CPD is arranged for you nationally. So you don't really need to do much to keep your qualifications up to date.
Some advisors have already kind of resigned their positions with the PFS. Do you see more of that happening? Yeah. And particularly, I suppose, as there are other bodies out there with which advisors can retain chartered status?
Yeah, I'm very much a CII person, so I don't really look at what others provide, but I know we have worldwide credibility. We've been around since 1897. We're well established, and we have a brand, and a really important brand, and I would hope that most people would understand that and work to resolve the issues that we have. As long as there is agreement and goodwill on both sides, and that people are not pulling up the drawbridge, we need to understand what the problems are on both sides, and they need to be aired, and we need to go forward. But yeah, you know, PFS members can go to alternative bodies, or even they could set up a new organization, but all of that can't be done, I dare say, instantly, especially with the latter. If you want to go to a competitor body, I don't know how your qualifications are transportable across to them, in that you've got CII, PFS ones. I don't know how others will regard those and whether they will give you parity. I don't know what changes are required. But if you were to set up a new organisation, that can't be done instantly. And don't forget, the CII reports into the Privy Council. And I don't know how people like that view what is going on. I can't imagine people outside the insurance and financial services sector are primarily have an interest in this bun fight. But at the end of the day, you know, we need to ensure people are confident when they engage with the insurance and financial services sector, and that they're working with credible professionals that are qualified, that support qualifications, that support professionalism, and that's what we're all about. You know, for me as a volunteer, I make no money in supporting the CII. Yes, I provide commercial training to local institutes, but you know, that to me is a small part of what I do. But all of this is down to professional ethics and integrity, in which, you know, I everything I do is that, and therefore I would want colleagues to do the same and not sort of be sort of looking at other stuff which is taking time out on this. And I don't think it should be happening. Let's air what the issues are, let's have some transparency. Here are the facts and figures, this is what the money's for, this is what it can't be used for, these are the options available, and what do we do to restore faith and trust and friendship or colleagueship or whatever you want to call it, so that going forward, you know, we've aired those issues, we've turned a new page.
Yeah, you're saying forming a new body wouldn't necessarily, it's one option, but it wouldn't necessarily iron out existing issues in this kind of established system.
Well, it would in a way, it would close those down, but you'd then want to take what part of the money was yours But how you then physically move that, you know, a brand new body, I don't know. You know, that money belongs to a limited company, which is part of an overall structure. Whether you know, a new body would be entitled to that, I very much doubt.
Yeah, and of course, as you said, that structure is ultimately sound with the CIA reporting.
Very sound. It's tried and tested. There are glitches. There are issues with examinations. The CIA has invested a massive amount of money in terms of new IT, which benefits CIA and PFS members, which has cost a huge amount of money. PFS, you know, there's an ironing out how much services are provided by the CIA that the PFS should pay for. There are issues that need to be sorted in a very sort of frank way.
Yeah, and also I'd just like to, I mean, sort of the risk of getting bogged down in detail, one of the contentious points in this whole dispute was, you know, a few years ago, the CIA sort of attempting to deregister the PFS. And that was a sort of plan that ultimately, you know, led to Keith Richards' resignation. And I think that's obviously, you know, a fear that PFS members have. And some, they would argue, a legitimate fear that they have. Could you speak about that as any kind of remote possibility, or if it's even on the remotely on the table?
Yeah, personally speaking, I don't know why. You know, when you get together with another organization, unless there is a decision at the start, and this goes back almost 20 years, you know, why run two separate brands? So a decision must have been made at that time to have two separate legal entities, CIA and PFS, in a group structure, with the PFS continuing forward, going forward as the brand for financial advisors. So a decision must have been made to carry on as two separate legal entities. And why then a decision was taken to try and close that legal entity down? To me, if you were a bit of a skeptic, you could say, well, that was so that we can have their money and they have no control over anything going forward. So at some time, the CIA and the PFS must have reviewed the decisions to go forward as two separate legal entities and constantly review them. And of course, then if you're a PFS member and suddenly you see the CII trying to remove, you know, to cancel your separate legal status, you are wondering, why is that being done? And without any transparency from the CII, you know, a skeptic, you know, I wouldn't be against supporting the concerns the skeptic has. It's like, with the CIA doing this, it's like, and Sean Fisher at the time, it's like, even I asked a question in some of the public meetings that we had. It's like, why is it being done? And are we better together? And it was sort of like the first part of the question wasn't answered. And of course, yes, we're better together. And Sarah Lord was the president at the time of the PFS. But I still can't understand what has to be gained if you deregister the PFS's separate legal status without some sort of clear and transparent disclosure.
I mean, broad question, Branko, but do you think it's something that should have been discussed at all in the first place?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you can't suddenly
as in
we're taking your keys, we're taking
yeah
your
no
car.
Sorry, I meant as in deregistration, like, should it have been something that was put on the table as a possibility in the first place?
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. This would have, Nicola, been saying that the bodies would have discussed at the outset. So whether it's a hostile takeover where their brand disappears, or it's a merger where both brands continue to trade as separate brand names within a group structure, I don't know. I wasn't privy to that level of detail. But assuming both bodies are happy with what is happening, then, you know, I can't see a particular problem. But if you're a PFS member, all you're seeing is all these little bits that add up to quite a bit. And are you really comfortable with what's going on? And hence, it's just basically got to the stage like, we're not happy with what is going on. And therefore, whether they want a special general meeting, they want to jump ship. I don't know where we are. The CIA has tried its best to put out messaging, but and we've had meetings, but, you know, people want specific answers to specific questions. A lot of debate on LinkedIn. If you're the PFS president, you know, the presidency of the CIO or PFS is an incredibly honourable professional position to hold. You're at the pinnacle of your professional body. And to resign it, it's just not done. You know, the last CIO president, he sort of resigned, was Michael Bright 23 years ago when his insurance company failed and he was tried for fraud and served 7 years, I think, in prison. So that's the only time, I think, in recent history that we've had someone resign their office.
Yeah. You mentioned, you know, I think at the start of this podcast, you mentioned that it's like a dispute at a family dinner.
Yeah.
And when you see these organizations, you know, seemingly disagreeing with each other about so many things that are quite fundamental, really, do you think that it is sensible, or do you think we should reevaluate the CIO holding chartered status? Because I'm speaking because I read an article by a financial planner, unfortunately I can't remember the name of, who I think had come over from a different country and was essentially just writing and saying that he was calling into question that organization of power, as it were, because in the country he'd come from, you didn't have to have your charter status tied to one single body, and therefore it was much easier to switch and change. Before, a lot of PFS members would argue now that they would like to depart from the CII, but they can't because, you know, of the charter status.
I don't see, you know, an advantage there in terms of transportability of chartered status. You know, your chartered accountant, there are two chartered bodies for accountants. You don't sort of switch and change. You know, the Chartered Insurance Institute, you've sat the examinations, you're awarded your diploma, your chartered status. You have to, in order to keep your post-nominal letters and receive the Statement of Professional Standing for PFS, you have to be a member. So you choose whether you want to be a member of the CII, PFS, or someone else. If there is someone else able to offer you the parallel accreditation and status. The CII has been around since 1897, so we're a professional chartered body, very proud of where we've been. And of course you will always get, you know, I've been involved in the centre since mid late 1990s, and we've always had issues to discuss and air, and we should be doing that. The CII needs to appreciate the value of all stakeholders and not dismiss their efforts or challenges or interactions, which some may think has happened quite recently. The CII will be nowhere with its volunteers, but also volunteers would be nowhere without the CII and the PFS also in terms of what they do. But the CII did start from a very local footing in that local institutes predate the CII. So whilst history shouldn't sort of be a millstone around our neck, it does certainly influence where we are now. It would be a very sad day for the CII not to appreciate fully the massive efforts from volunteers and other stakeholders.
Branko, obviously the PFS are, you know, putting a lot of effort into sort of standing their ground and remaining where they are as a body. And, you know, we recently found out that they you know, spent almost $1 million on legal and loan advice to avoid the, you know, what some advisors have called a coup, but to avoid, what they mean is to avoid the CII, you know, accessing some of their cash. And I guess for the PFS members that are still standing and not happy about what has happened in recent months, you know, what can those individual PFS members, what can you see them doing, and how can you see this playing out in terms of the PFS really trying to resist, you know, what they consider to be advances by the CII?
If I was sitting at the CII in a senior executive position, I would be wanting to work every day to resolve the matter. So chatting with the PFS executive, their board, allowing the more vociferous commentators to have their thoughts aired. Let's discuss everything. Let's agree, you know, what are our red lines on both sides? Is there so much disagreement that we can't get together? Does this need to involve some sort of independent resolution whereby someone from outside insurance and financial services comes together just to either knock heads together or just to understand what it is? Because a lot of PFS people don't trust a lot of CII people. It's obviously clear when you read the commentary on LinkedIn, and for the chairman of the CII board, Helen Phillips, to, you know, for someone to cancel her invitation to a dinner, that's just, you know, I've never seen that happen before. Yeah. So it is trust has to be restored. But if at the same time, if I don't know what the advice has been to the PFS, having spent that huge amount of money, I don't know what the advice is saying to them. So is this our money? Can we take it? What can we do? But don't forget, if the board is filled or has the majority of CII appointments, the board itself, you know, will not be able to pass a resolution. So it appears to be an impasse whereby, if you wanted to take action, I don't know what action you'd be able to take. And yeah, don't forget, for the PFS to spend that sort of money, it's like you're seriously not trusting your parent or your fellow group company in respect of what you're being told. And that, to me, really doesn't sit well.
Absolutely. And as you mentioned earlier, you know, there's it's a monumental distraction from the challenges financial services faces at a time when, you know, there are so many other pressing matters, and also a financial drain. I mean, it was the other day that we broke the news that I believe £800,000 has been spent by the PFS consult on legal advice regarding CII loans, and that's, you know, not just time but obviously resources spent to that. And just going back to the accounts point for a moment, because I believe you wrote as part of an AGM last year for an item of special business, calling for an auditor of the accounts and management at the CII. Could you just elaborate a little for me just on why this was requested, and what you thought, what you spotted that wasn't potentially, you know, all in order in the CII?
I'm not an accountant. I was just after some independent analysis on, you know, explain this to us. Who owns the money? Who generated the money? What can the money be used for? Can the CII use the money? Does the CII need the money? Where would the CII be current financial position without that on the group balance sheet? Of course, the CII, Alan Valance made this point in discussions a couple of weeks ago. The CII is audited and accounts are prepared in the normal way. But it's just to get some transparent understanding in respect of that money. And going forward, you know, who earns what? Who has to pay what to what? What benefits we get for that money? What is it going to cost us? How much the CII has spent? Because there's a lot of concern. The CII, I think, had a huge amount of money in the accounts sort of 3 to 5 years ago. And that seems to have dwindled down to very, very little indeed. So just to understand, yeah, where has it gone? Has the new IT system cost that much? I realised that there was a huge amount required to move the pension, the final sort of salary thing that we used to have, into legal and general. That would have cost a lot of money. But just to understand where this money has gone. So accounts are always summary at the highest level possible. And it's just to drill down further for everyone to understand. No one's alleging mispropriety at all. But what we're just saying is, where did that money go from? We had millions and millions in the accounts a few years ago. It's like, where's it gone? I don't understand if an IT system costs that much. We have moved twice. The CII building was sold and we moved into Lombard Street, and now we're in another building, and it's like Fenchurch Street, and it's like, that must cost money, and we're sharing with another body at the moment. That must cost money. So it's just understanding those sorts of things so that we can be assured that people are making the right decisions on our behalf.
Yeah, and on that, you know, The CII, denied that at the time, and it was cited that a notice period was the reason why it wasn't given enough notice. I wanted to ask what your thoughts are on pushing for all of those accounts, and also the claim that from a PFS member that Evelyn orders from Evelyn Partners told the PFS that there was a significant risk that the CII would fail to repay a loan, and whether that speaks to the sort of uncharted waters that we're treading here in terms of looking at the accounts and not really, as you said, not really knowing where money's gone.
Yeah, if the CII requires PFS money to stay afloat, can that be done? That money, the 20 million, I think, surplus that the PFS have generated, is that accessible to the CII, and on what terms?
Yeah.
And does the CII really need that to stay afloat? And if it didn't receive it, is external funding possible from other organisations? I don't know what collateral we have now. I don't know how much cash we have in the bank. It is just to understand our solvency going forward, and for us to be aware of what our membership body is doing on our behalf. So it's been, local institutes at the start of COVID gave up a lot of money to help up the CII, and we naturally hope that that was done for the right reason. If the CII now wants to, as it were, do a cash raid on PFS, just tell everyone that that's the case.
Yeah.
Why and what then happens? And then back to the earlier comments, if the PFS board is full of CII people or has a majority, then obviously voting becomes easier for decisions of that nature. But if you're a local PFS member and you're suddenly sitting there thinking, hold on a minute, is that PFS money? We've helped generate this money. Why does the PFS, why does the CII need it? And what are the ramifications for both bodies regarding money? So a bit of transparency on that in really clear, unambiguous terminology, I think, would help people with this.
And the ramifications for members as well, who of course pay for their membership, from a personal perspective, I imagine they're quite interested to know as well.
Which, we all have a vested interest. We're all stakeholders. This is our professional body, and we pay into the professional body, and we get certain benefits for that. But we want to make sure that the stewardship of the professional body is in good hands.
Absolutely, yeah. And I just wanted to, sort of going back quite a bit, but I just wanted to clarify for the podcast. Earlier when we were talking about the recent history of the PFS and CII, what do you think of those claims of significant governance failings by the CII? Because that was, I think that's quite a marker, because that was the justification for appointing so many, CII board members to the PFS.
Yeah, if you've been able to continually provide qualifications and accreditation and everything else, and you've accumulated a huge amount of money, that to me suggests pretty good stewardship. So I'm not entirely privy as to what the corporate governance failings were. And don't forget, there were CII people already on the board beforehand. So, what were they noting? What challenge was there? The board is there to challenge the executive of the PFS, and with the president of the PFS having an important role on that particular board. So a lot of intelligent, noteworthy people have occupied that particular role, and therefore what is the CII saying in terms of what corporate governance failings have there been? Why weren't they spotted earlier? And to me, whether it requires a corporate governance review by an external independent organisation to actually understand what's going on, where decisions have been made badly, or, the CII saying decisions haven't really been made in our favour, and we think we're a bit upset with this.
We spoke about potential. I mean, there's kind of allegations on both sides here, but we spoke about the potential of a sort of cultural difference between the CI and PFS, which, you know, you helpfully said was probably not a case. And, you know, we're all people, we all love networking. They all work with each other and have to know about each other's business as well.
PFS members have to be qualified.
Yeah.
And they have to be annually signed off, regulator requirement. So that is a big cultural difference to general insurance people that don't have to be qualified. No one has to sign off their competence.
Yeah.
General insurance brokers still earn commission. A percentage slice on the product that they've sold from the insurer. So there is a big cultural difference there. And the CII, you know, wants to ensure that both GI and financial services have parity. But at the moment, it's like this, PFS here and GI here. Because GI people don't have to be qualified. Yet the advice that they're giving to corporate clients and individuals is significant, and not to be professionally qualified, I think, is not good. Really, it sends the wrong message. But only the regulator can impose professional qualifications. And the 15 hours CPD requirement under something called the Insurance Distribution Directive is not much. It's just over an hour a month. Whereas financial services people may almost laugh and think, well, they don't have to be professionally qualified. There's competence signed off.
It's
like, there is a cultural difference. But when it comes to coexisting, there's not much of a culture shift there in that we all choose to get involved to support our members locally and nationally. So there's no like hierarchical, well, he's CI and he's PFS. That doesn't happen.
Yeah.
But we do need to always work closer together. So the annual event that we had in May last year, Ambassadors in Action, we need to carry that on. We need to have a close working relationship between both bits nationally and locally. And people need to come together to enable that to happen.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That sounds, Branko, thank you so much. That sounds like a great note to end on.
Branko, it's been brilliant to have you and hear your perspective, both as an onlooker, as you said, but also as somebody who has history working in and with these organisations. So thank you very, very much for your time today. It's been brilliant to chat to you. And thank you very much, everyone, for listening. If you'd like to get in contact with any kind of questions or comments about this episode, you can email Zachariah. I'm at nblackburn@citywire.co.uk. Zach is zsharif@citywire.co.uk. Or feel free to reach out on Twitter. We're at New Model Advisor. And thank you very much again for listening, everyone.
Thank you so much, Branko.
Thank you for allowing me to take part.
Scottish Mortgage seeks out lateral thinkers like academics, authors, and experts in the industry to shape our investment ideas. Not the usual suspects and narrow mindset of financial analysts and investment industry commentators. That way, we continue to build a portfolio that reflects real-world progress, not financial world noise. Scottish Mortgage is managed by Baillie Gifford. A key information document is available by visiting baillieGifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk.